The Letters, Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith.
Welcome to At The Letters. Ben Nicholson-Smith here in Toronto. Arden Zwelling is not in Toronto, but he will join me over the phone very shortly, and we'll talk Devin Travis, we'll talk Justin Smoke, keeps hitting home runs, Jason Grilley keeps allowing them. All things Blue Jays will be discussed with Arden. And then after that, we'll talk to Jim Callis from MLBpipeline.com, really one of the foremost draft experts out there. And with the draft coming up in just 5 days, it's the perfect time to ask Jim about two-way players, about teams, and whether they're getting better at drafting players, and even a look ahead at who the Jays might take when they're selecting 22nd and 28th overall. All that coming up on At The Letters.
The batter, right-handed hitting, Ryan Healy. Lines one on the first pitch to left center field, moving over Carrera. He dives and it goes by him all the way to the wall. Davis in to score. Healy will stop at second. He's driven in another run. Five last night. Here an RBI double. And Oakland out in front 4-1 as Carrera went over. Dove headlong and could not make the play. His glove went flying off his hand. The 0-2 pitch. Fastball. Strike three called. Oakland wins it 4-1 despite being out hit 8-7. Casilla with his second straight save. And the A's have won the first two games on this West Coast trip for the Blue Jays.
We are back on At The Letters and joined by Arden Zwelling, who is not here in studio, but who is on assignment and joining us over the phone. Arden, how's it going?
What's going on, man? How are things?
Things are good. Things are good here in Toronto. Less good out in Oakland, where the Jays have lost two in a row. I mean, this is not that you can ever make assumptions about what's going to happen when you're facing a sub-500 team, but this was a pretty good chance for them to make up some ground.
Yeah, you know, the games have been a little bit sloppy the first couple games against Oakland. You know, we'll see if the Blue Jays can salvage a game, avoid a sweep. But when you kind of look at this spot in the schedule, this is a time where the Blue Jays need to make some hay. You know, you look at Oakland, Seattle, Tampa, the White Sox, the Rangers, the Royals. These are not great teams. This is not the creme de la creme. And I think that the Blue Jays, you know, need to make up some wins over these next few weeks, because when they go into the All-Star break, if you've kind of looked ahead that far, you've got Baltimore, Boston, New York, and then four against the Houston Astros, who might be the best team in baseball. So that's going to be a pretty rough stretch. So this is a really crucial kind of couple weeks here for the Blue Jays, and they're not off to a good start.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the next little chunk of the Jays schedule, they're probably facing the three worst teams in the American League, because Oakland would have to be in that group. Then the White Sox come to town, and just for a couple games, but still they're in that group as well. And I think the Royals at this point have to be considered in that group, just because of the way they're playing. They don't look like a very good ball club either.
Yeah, they're a disaster right now. You know, and the American League is interesting because there aren't too many true rebuilding clubs. You know, all their, you know, real, like, we are rebuilding, we're going to lose a ton of games clubs are kind of in the National League. So, you know, you can even kind of, like, look at, you know, the standings. You look at the AL East, the Blue Jays are in last, and they're only six games back of first. You know, and there aren't too many divisions like that across baseball. But, you know, yeah, these are some teams that the Blue Jays should be beating, for sure.
What's the point in the year that you start looking at the standings? Because for me, we're kind of at that point. I almost don't look at them for the first little couple months of the year, and now I actually start looking at them every day or close to every day. Does that line up at all with how you approach it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a difference between looking at them and reading into them. Yeah. You know, like I've been looking at them every day since the beginning of the season, just to kind of know what's going on. But, you know, yeah, like I think it's when do you start taking seriously kind of the number in the games back column, or, you know, how the wild card race is shaping up. But I think it's, you know, still far too early for that, you know, because you can look at it so many ways. Like, you look at the Blue Jays, let me pull it up right now. The Blue Jays are 3.5 games back at the second wild card spot, but there's five teams between them and Baltimore, who was in that second wild card spot. So it's kind of like, how do you want to look at this thing? So I think that, you know, right now what's more informative is probably, you know, run differential, or, you know, Pythagorean record and things like that.
Yeah. And for anyone wondering, the Jays are negative 11 in that department right now. So not like they're being unlucky when it comes to runs scored and runs allowed, but they are definitely dealing with a lot of injuries, and that is an ongoing struggle with them. Devin Travis, now the latest Blue Jay to hit the disabled list, and I was a little surprised when we saw that he was hitting the DL because of a knee issue, a right knee issue, instead of that hand.
Yeah, you know, John Gibbons had kind of mentioned, just kind of as an aside, a couple times over the last couple weeks that, you know, yeah, Devin Travis is, you know, he's still got that knee thing, and, you know, he's banged up and this and that, but then he'd go out and, you know, hit a couple doubles, you know, and he looked mobile and good at second base and makes all the plays you expect him to. So, you know, yeah, it was interesting how this cropped up, but, you know, there's nothing like a 5 or 6 hour flight from coast to coast to yeah. really mess up your knee.
Yeah, goes to show, too, that you can be flying in the best, you know, charter jets, and you can have all this treatment, and you're still prone to stiffening up like anybody else. But he's obviously put this thing through a whole lot of testing, and he's put it through a whole lot of wear and tear in the course of the last couple months. So to me, when people throw around labels like injury prone, I think it's unfair. I think that, you know, Travis is someone who's just dealing with a chronic knee issue right here, one that, or I shouldn't say chronic, but at least recurring knee issue. And if you're playing on turf, if you're playing every single day, it's really tough to limit the wear and tear and limit the kind of impact that a baseball season has on that part of the body.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who wants to, you know, begrudge Devin Travis for having dealt with injuries during his career, you know, yeah, throw the injury prone label on him, right? You know, they can go do something to themselves that I can't say right now. But, you know, that's you feel for Devin Travis more than anything. And when you hear, you know, the words bone bruise and you're hearing about there's some cartilage issues, which is something that he's dealt with in the past. I think the operation this offseason was actually to clean up some cartilage that was bothering him in his knee there. You know, you do, like, yeah, I seriously wonder if we're going to see him again this year.
Wow.
I don't know where you stand on that, but I'm not sure we're going to see him again on the field this year. When you know, a bone bruise, I mean, this robbed Michael Saunders of an entire season, you know, and a bone bruise is an injury that really, really hurts. It's really deep inside of your body or in your knee. It's tough to get out. It needs a ton of rest, and it can be a bit deceiving and a bit deceptive of when you're ready to come back. I mean, you really have to get to that like 110% point before you come back, because it's an injury that's very easy to re-aggravate. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts, but I would, you know, I'm wondering if we're going to see Devin Travis again this year.
Wow. Yeah, that's a huge potential loss for the Jays, and definitely in the short term. For the way I look at it right now is that you see Devin Travis's reaction. He's emotional after hearing the news and talking to the media. That's a sign that he's not thinking this is a 3-day thing, right? This is something that has a chance at least to linger. And even John Gibbons, every time that the Blue Jays have put someone on the DL, and this year it's already been 17, 18 times, we've heard him say, I mean, how many times has he said, oh yeah, we think it's going to be the minimum 10 days? And that's almost the default, right? That's just how they talk about these things for the most part, whether it turns out to be true or not. And in Travis's case, he's not saying that, because this is clearly going to take more time than that. It's clearly a medium to long-term question as opposed to a short-term to day-to-day question. Came out of nowhere, but at this point, yeah, I mean, you can't expect him back. I mean, I'd say it'd be a surprise if he comes back in the first half. So I'd go that far. And then beyond that, you don't know. I mean, it's so hard to tell from a distance, but it's not good news for the Jays.
No, I mean, and you, yeah, the verbiage and, you know, kind of the words that you're hearing from the teammates, especially, I mean, that's what really, it's home. And I think that you look at the injury history of the player too, and the fact that Devin Travis has been through knee issues in the past. And, you know, do you think the Blue Jays are going to, you know, rush him one iota, or, you know, to take any, you know, cut any corner or do anything any faster than they have to? This is, you know, something that you look at how good Devin Travis can be when he's healthy. I mean, it really has to be a focus and a project for the Blue Jays right now to find a way to let Devin Travis play a full season and to let him be on the field and to be himself and to be as good as he can be and to not have this be a recurring thing throughout his career. And I think it's helpful that the Blue Jays have certainly no shortage of, you know, of medical staff and then trainers and physical therapists and people like that who study this stuff and can work at it. Consulting doctors, they have consulting surgeons and people who work at universities who specialize and stuff like this who can help them. It also probably helps to have a guy like Troy Tulowitzki in the clubhouse. He's a guy who dealt with, you know, recurring hip issues earlier in his career. You know, a lot of people wondered about if he was ever going to be able to play a full season. And, you know, I think that his insight is going to be important in this. But, yeah, I mean, with Devin Travis right now, the Blue Jays, you know, they can't be thinking about, all right, how do we get him back on the field this year? How do we get him, you know, to help us push towards playoffs? They have to be thinking, how do we get him to a point where this isn't something that he carries for the rest of his career?
Yeah. So, you don't think they would be thinking about this year as well and trying to get him back for the playoff push? Because, I mean, that's part of the challenge they're facing here is to try to. I mean, the division probably out of the question for them, so they're probably in a close race for a wild card spot. I mean, every game could count.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that the way the season plays out will take care of that.
Yeah.
We mentioned earlier that, you know, what the Blue Jays are looking at going into the All-Star break. I mean, you know, that's going to tell us a lot about where this team's going to be is how they come through that stretch of really, really good teams they're going to play there. But I don't know. To me, the focus has to be how do we, you know, get Devin Travis healthy for the rest of his career, not just for this season. You know, and if you bring him back this year and say he gets back on the field in, you know, August, September, whatever, plays out the rest of the year, but he's not truly a 100% and he ends up, you know, having to then kind of rehab again in the off season. I mean, you can't have this kind of yo-yo thing. You know, you want to get him to a point where he's fully healthy, he's fully over everything, and he's able to, you know, at least be on your active roster for 162, which is something he hasn't been able to do in 3 years now.
Yeah. Yeah. You certainly don't want to rush it. I don't know if you ever expect, and it's funny, almost in today's day and age, I don't know if you ever expect anyone to play 162 anymore. I mean, it just seems like, it seems like you've got to be prepared to go to those backups.
Well, I think be on the active roster, you know, nobody plays 162,
sure.
But to not go to the DL.
Yeah.
You know, to be available for every game. That's kind of the goal these days.
Yeah. So in his absence, we're going to be looking at Ryan Goins, Darwin Barney, maybe a little bit of Chris Coughlin at second base, although judging on what we've seen from him in the infield, I doubt we see much of him at second. So what do you make of where the Blue Jays are at right now with Goins and Barney filling in for Travis? And one of those guys is going to be in there every day right now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure John Gibbons will go forward with kind of that platoon for a little bit, if he even plays it like a platoon. I mean, we've seen him make some interesting decisions there before. Yeah, you know, you kind of wonder if, you know, maybe at some point they take a look at a Jason Lebedjian, as I butcher his name, or you know, maybe even a Jake Elmore or somebody if they do get that desperate. But just as the season develops, that kind of decision at the end of spring training to keep Ryan Goins over Melvin Upton Jr. continues to look like a better and better decision as, you know, the needs present themselves as this season goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the right call. Goins has been very, very valuable to this team. At the same time, you look at his offensive numbers, and he's got a career OPS of 600. Darwin Barney has a career OPS of 636. So not to say they couldn't go on a hot streak, but compared to Travis, and especially compared to Travis's May, this is going to be an offensive downgrade.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, anybody is going to be a downgrade from Travis's May. He was one of the best hitters in baseball. But, you know, how many teams have a hitter like that at second base? You know, I think we kind of forget how rare that is. You know, even at shortstop with Troy Tulowitzki, I think we forget how rare it is to have like a 25-homer guy at shortstop. What do you think of this platoon going forward?
Yeah, I think it's a product of the Blue Jays not having a great utility guy that they can sub in, you know, and you look around, it's not every team that has one, but the best teams a lot of the time do have that guy. And for the Jays, it could have been Steve Pierce if things had materialized differently. He's someone who does have some experience at second base, and this is part of the reason they brought him in, is that if he had been healthy and performing, then he's someone who could have conceivably been an option at second for them, just based on his career experience. But you look at teams like the Astros, and they have Marwin Gonzalez, who can play a lot of different positions. The Cubs, of course, have guys like Ben Zobrist and Javi Baez. To me, that's one of the hallmarks of a really good team, is you have a guy on the bench who can step in and contribute offensively and defensively. The Jays have the defense, and to their credit, Goins and Barney have gotten a couple big hits this year, but in the big picture, those guys don't have the same offensive track record.
You know what? We forget about Steve Pierce a little bit, don't we?
Yeah.
That's a guy who could factor in there. You know, I didn't even think about that. Absolutely. I mean, he's played second before, and look, he doesn't look like a second baseman, and he's probably not going to make too many, defensive highlight plays. But if he can come back from this calf injury and hit the way he has in his career, he could kind of step towards replacing that offensive production at second base. If the Blue Jays even want to use him there, maybe they bring him back and they want to use him in left field so that they're not relying on Ezekiel Carrera as much as they are right now.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's been an adventure out there at times. And Carrera, the Jays, the way they look at him seems to be, he's great to have out there for a few days, but he can get exposed if he's out there too much.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. I feel like we've been saying that for years.
Yep, I that's probably true.
So, but you know, they're in the situation right now with injuries where they're having to play him as much as they are, and they're having to play Ryan Goins as much as they are, and Darwin Barney. But you know, look at the baseball season. You know, who came into it expecting that there wouldn't be injuries? And you know, the Blue Jays are probably as healthy now as they have been since opening day. When you look at what they've been through, it's going to be interesting to see how, you know, what happens going forward. And you know, look, if the Blue Jays front office is thinking, all right, we're going to make a push for the playoffs in August, September, maybe they need to look at trying to add a utility guy at the deadline who can, you know, like you said, fill in at second, or, you know, even, you know, an outfield corner, or, you know, give Josh Donaldson a day off at third base, this, that, and the other. You know, it's too early to kind of look at that, but it would be interesting to play that.
On the other side of the offensive ledger, you've got a guy in Justin Smoke who has 15 home runs, and it's always a little ridiculous to look at pace numbers, but if you were to prorate what Justin Smoke has done over the course of a 6-month season, he'd be on track for 41 homers, 110 RBI, 283 average, 913 OPS. I mean, these are incredible numbers that he's putting up right now. Are you getting to the point that you're buying in on Justin Smoke as a guy who's having a breakout type season?
It's hard to ignore the track record and to just see how those numbers look in contrast to it. And I think we also kind of have that recent memory of, you know, the start that Michael Saunders had last year and his first half and how things played out over the second half. But, you know, I also think it's kind of unfair to kind of compare players like that. Like, you know, they're different guys, you know, and we've seen breakout campaigns. You know, why not compare Justin Smoke to somebody, I don't have a great example off the top of my head, but to somebody who had a great breakout campaign at the age of 30. So, you know, it's tough. But, you know, look, he's making great contact. He's hitting lefties all of a sudden. That's weird. And he's playing every day and taking advantage of the opportunities that he has. You know, he's probably underpaid at this point, as John Gibbons said the other day. Will it continue? We'll see. The hardest thing to do is to put together a, you know, opening day to end of the season consistent, productive campaign. How many players can do that without going into some kind of a funk or some kind of a slump at some point? So it's the hardest thing to do in baseball. But certainly, you know, these first 60 or so games have been really, really encouraging, don't you think?
Yeah, they've been unlike any 60 games I've seen from Justin Smoke to this point. That's for sure. And they've been really impressive. The thing that I would point to, and I don't know if this is necessarily predictive, I don't know if we should read into it all that much, but crunched a few numbers yesterday on Justin Smoke, and so I looked at all the hitters in 2016 who had at least 300 at-bats, okay? And then from there, I compared all those hitters to the qualified hitters in 2017. So you're essentially looking at this year and last year, guys who played a lot. Then I looked at the guys who have cut their strikeout rate the most. And the guy who's done it more than any other hitter in baseball is Justin Smoke. He's cut down from 32.8% of the time in 16. Now he's striking out 18% of the time. So that's a big drop-off. And for a guy that we think of as being strikeout prone, he's actually been a lot harder to strike out. He's actually making a lot more contact this year.
He's making a ton more contact, and he's also walking less, which is kind of interesting. I mean, it looks like he's really going up with a plan to put the bat on the ball, and it's working out for him. And, you know, he could be hitting a bit better. I mean, I'm looking at his batting average and balls in play right now. It's .281. Last year it was .295. So, you know, he could be having a bit more luck than he has been, and maybe his numbers could even look even better than they have been. So, you know, that indicates to me a guy who's maybe getting challenged a bit more, getting some more pitches to hit. But if he's also kind of cut down on kind of chasing that bad breaking ball and that pitch in the dirt that we've seen him swing over so many times in his career, if he's kind of been able to eliminate that from his game and make that adjustment, well, then you're going to see more pitches to hit, and you're going to be able to, you know, barrel balls more because you're swinging at pitchers that are just pitches that are in the strike zone. I've seen the same thing with Kevin Pillar. I'd imagine that the league's going to make an adjustment to Justin Smoke at some point, and they're, you know, as they get more data and more video and more analysis, they're going to say, okay, this is how we're going to attack him now, and then Justin Smoke's going to have to deal with that. We'll see when that comes, but so far so good.
Yeah, and when he's getting fastballs, he's not missing them as much. Last year, he missed more fastballs in the strike zone when opposing pitchers would challenge him. He's just not missing them as often. So it's gonna lead to better results if you're not swinging through a lot of fastballs.
Yeah, and you know, and Justin Smoke's always been a tremendous fastball hitter. I mean, this is a guy with a really smooth power swing, you know, and that's why he was the top prospect in baseball at one point, because people said, you know, look, he's a switch hitter who hits for power, who can crush mistakes. You know, this guy's going to be a good hitter for a long time. Who knows? Maybe it just took him, you know, this long to kind of figure out his approach or figure out what works best for him. I mean, well, you know, I'm very interested to see the back half of this year. You know, I want to be very cautious in saying, oh, Justin Smoke's great now. You know, we'll see what happens, but so far so good.
Yeah, we have less reason to be cautious when it comes to Josh Donaldson. When you look at what he's been able to do since coming back, it's essentially as though he didn't miss any time. I mean, Donaldson has produced at an MVP level since returning to the field from his calf injury, and it really does seem as though he didn't miss a beat. It's pretty incredible to see one of the best hitters in baseball doing what he does.
Yeah, you know, nothing surprises me of Josh Donaldson. I mean, he just understands his swing so well. And I think about that game, man, I forget who he was playing, but he hit the two home runs in the game at Rogers Center.
Since
it was last week. Sorry? It was a Cincy?
Reds, yeah, it might have been. Reds or
Yankees. Yeah, he hit two dingers, and, like, neither of them were mistake pitches. Like, neither of them were grooved. One was in on his hands, and he, like, pulled his hands in and still was able to execute a really good swing and hit over the wall. And the other was, like, below the strike zone, like, not even a strike. And he almost Adrian Beltre-esque dropped down to one knee and golfed the ball out of the yard. So, you know, that's really impressive. Because, look, we know Josh Donaldson can hammer a hanging slider. Like, we know that, you know, if he gets a 3-1 fastball right down the chute, that he can absolutely crush that pitch. But seeing him execute on some of the pitcher's pitches, you know, some of the pitches where the pitcher's like, man, like, I felt like I threw a good pitch there, and I'm still getting a new ball. That's the stuff that really impresses me about Josh Donaldson. I think that's what separates him as one of the truly elite hitters in this game. And that comes down to, you know, the work that he does in the video room and in the cages, you know, video of his own swing and analyzing everything he's doing at the plate and, you know, just, you know, being in sync with his hands and his feet, all this stuff that he talks about, you know, being on plane with the ball, not hitting ground balls, the, you know, uppercut swing, whatever, however you want to put it, all this stuff that he goes into detail on in his many hitting videos. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that translates, in, you know, at the plate, and we're seeing it.
Yeah, and I think the result of that is that when he's in the lineup, the Blue Jays have quite a good offense. And when he's not, they really don't. So he's really that guy who transforms this offense from being kind of ordinary to actually good.
Yeah, you know, I think that the Blue Jays are still dangerous when, you know, if they're lining up Bautista, Morales, Smoke, Tulo, Martin through, you know, the heart of their order. I mean, I think that's still good. Adding Josh Donaldson to it makes it better. But, you know, I think you've got five home run threats right there. I mean, Kendrys Morales makes really, really hard contact. Jose Bautista, you know, had a great month of May. He's kind of slumping a little bit right now, but, you know, he's still a threat. But certainly Josh Donaldson added to that group makes it that much deeper.
Yeah, so let's get to the bullpen. A couple moves, or one move for the Blue Jays that involves swapping out a couple of lefties, J.P. Howell going to the disabled list, and Jeff Béliveau coming up. He got into a game the other day. And then the next day when Travis went down, the Blue Jays brought up Dominic Leone, who's really been pretty respectable in that bullpen. So Howell on the DL, what do you make of, I mean, they just weren't using him. I'm not sure necessarily how serious this injury is, but it probably is more helpful to have Béliveau up than Howell, I would imagine.
Yeah, you know, I don't know a lot about Jeff Béliveau. I didn't get really a chance to see him throw too much at spring training, but, you know, it never hurts to have another lefty around. Even though Aaron Loop is still kind of the first lefty out of the pen there, it's nice to have a second one. If there's another situation that you want to use him in, or if, you know, the starter only goes 2 1/3 and it's one of those nights where Aaron Loop has to throw 2 or 3 innings, which we've seen a couple times with Howell, man. I mean, you know, it's tough, man. If you went around that clubhouse and you were like, I'm giving out the good guy award,
yeah,
and you asked everybody in that clubhouse, I mean, I think a lot of them would vote for JP Howell. And I think that the team really does value kind of the leadership that he brings and just kind of that, you know, the presence of a veteran in that bullpen. But at the same time, he just has not been major league caliber as a pitcher this year and as a reliever. And I think that's why you see the team kind of, you know, battling with, you know, going 2 weeks without using him and then only using him in super low leverage spots and then putting him on the DL with kind of mysterious injuries that I think everybody is, you know, pretty aware of, that they aren't, you know, it's that he, if his numbers were fine and if he was performing fine, he probably wouldn't be on the DL. You know what I mean?
You're saying he's on the DL with a case of an 8.31 ERA?
Is that what you think?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm sure he has a sore shoulder, no doubt, but they're not going to miss his presence on the roster is the point. And
I think a lot of guys have sore shoulders is the thing.
Yeah.
You know? And
right.
I think that if sometimes you might just think that a player just needs a little break, even mentally, or even just, you just need that roster spot and you just need that flexibility.
Yeah, exactly. And he had been used actually a little bit more in the last week or so. So very well could lead to a sore shoulder. And at that point, you want a fresh arm up the way teams are using rosters. Jason Grilley, I mean, what do you make of him? Of course, he had the 4 home run outing on the weekend. The Yankees were just hammering his sliders one after the other after the other. And right now, you know, you look at the numbers, they're really not pretty. So what do you make of what's going on with Jason Grilley?
It's just on the plate, man. He's been on the plate all year, and I think that he would admit that, you know, that his location has not been where it needs to be. And look, when you're a two-pitch pitcher, as Jason Grilley is, fastball slider, you're throwing one or the other. If one of them isn't working, and you know, hitters, you know, don't believe you can spot that fastball or that they, you know, you can get that fastball by them, if they feel they can guard against that and you're leaving your slider on the plate, then the approach, you know, becomes pretty easy, I think, for hitters to kind of sit on those sliders and be able to hammer them for home runs if they believe they can defend against the fastball and if they believe Jason Grilley's going to leave a slider, you know, in the zone. I mean, it's just about getting the barrel to it.
Do you think that he's got another couple of good months in him where he can go on a run? Because, I mean, so right now they're not using him in leverage, right? So he doesn't offer them leverage innings at this point. And he doesn't really serve the role of a mop-up man at this point because they don't like using him on back-to-back days, and he's good for one inning at a time. So he's not a leverage guy. He's not a mop-up guy. So if you're carrying him on the roster, you'd better believe that he's got another good run in him as a leverage guy. Or what's the point?
No, yeah, I agree with you. And I think the Blue Jays probably looked to that. I think it was 8 or 10 outings in a row where he was all right, you know, where he was pitching better and he was throwing better. And then obviously there was, you know, the disaster against the Yankees. You know, I think they'd probably pit, you know, look to that stretch as indicating that maybe there's something left and maybe he can still get it done. I mean, it's difficult to find, you know, positive things to say about what he's done this year. But, you know, he's another guy that I think the club values in the clubhouse. And I think the club values in the bullpen and values as a leader. But, you know, that can only carry you so far. At a certain point, the performance has to be there as well. And, you know, this would be a real bad scenario if Ryan Tepera and Danny Barnes hadn't emerged, if Joe Smith hadn't shown up having the season of his career. You know, if Roberto Osuna was still having the struggles that he had earlier this year, then, I mean, this would be real dire straits, and maybe you would have seen a couple, you know, DFAs or moves made, because the Blue Jays just needed somebody to give them reliable innings in the bullpen. But, you know, with that kind of back four of Barnes, Tapera, Smith, and Osuna pitching so well, the Blue Jays have been afforded the ability to kind of, you know, carry Howell, carry Grilly, and see if they can work through what they're going through right now.
So at this point, if you look at Major League relievers, Grilly's FIP of 8.83 is second worst among big league relievers. If you zoom out beyond this year, last calendar year, so since this date in 2016, he has allowed 17 homers, which is more than any relief pitcher in Major League Baseball. Even if you look at his tenure with the Blue Jays overall, he's got a 4.98 ERA. So, you know, it's tough, right? Because like you said, he's someone who is a fan favorite. He's someone who's well-liked in that clubhouse by a lot of people. So, you know, what do you do? But it's ultimately got to come down to performance.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, look, I mean, age will come for us all then, you know. I mean, Jason Grilly, he turns 41 this year, I believe. And look, credit to him that the ball still comes out at 93, 94, you know, which is great. I mean, we saw some of the velocities during spring training, and I think some of us were pretty worried. And it's good that, you know, Jason Grilly's been able to get to his arm to a point where he's throwing hard. But I think that sometimes we underestimate the physical toll that location can take, and like how hard it is to just repeat a mechanic that allows you to locate a pitch. I mean, that takes a great deal of core strength and a great deal of of strength all over your body, really. And you know, you just wonder about a 41-year-old reliever sometimes, I guess.
Yeah, fair enough. Arden, you are a busy man. We will let you go, but thanks for joining us.
All right, thanks, Ben.
Here's the 0-2 to Bichette. Swing, line drive, right field line. Base hit. Boy, he inside out of that one with a plum. In the score comes Sané. Palacios holds at third. Bichette all the way to second with a double. It's a 4-for-4 game for Bo Bichette. And the Lugnuts tack on a run here in the sixth. It's now 7-3.
Very pleased to be joined now by Jim Callis of MLBpipeline.com. At Jim Callis MLB on Twitter, and really one of the preeminent draft experts in the world. Jim, it is great to be joined by you, and thanks for making the time.
Oh yeah, no problem, Ben. Thanks for the very kind introduction.
Well, it's accurate, I think, especially this time of year when we've got so much draft chatter, and really you're at the forefront of it, looking around not only in the first round, but well beyond that as far as what teams might do. But before we get started at looking at specific players, what is this overall draft class looking like in a very big picture sense?
You know, it's funny. I feel like every year the vibe we get from scouts, you know, with the exception of 2011, which was a really strong draft, is that, oh, the talent's disappointing, the college position players aren't that good. And it'd be very easy to write that every year. But I just think it's kind of an average draft, because I think that's what we see every year. The teams are very aggressive about signing players out of high school. And, you know, we're going to look back. And, you know, 5 years from now, there will be some very good players that come out of this draft. I think there's a clear top five guys at the top who are very interesting. And then we'll look back, and there'll be a guy in the fifth round. There'll be a guy in the tenth round who become all-stars that we didn't see coming. So I think it's an ordinary draft. You know, I think teams always wish there was more talent. But it's just kind of ordinary, and it's kind of an odd year in that I don't even know if there's a particular strength. I thought coming in we maybe had a chance to have 6 or 7 of the first 12 picks. Might be college pitchers. And it isn't so much that they got hurt, but just guys kind of regressed a little bit. And so I don't even think there's really a strength. I mean, if there's a position that's stronger than usual, it's the position that teams probably are the least excited about, which would be first base, that depending on whether Louisville two-way star Brennan McKay gets taken as a hitter or pitcher, there could be 4 first basemen taken in the top 15 or 20 picks.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask about Brennan McKay and in tandem with Hunter Green, because these two-way players are just so interesting. Do these guys, is there any chance that the teams that draft them would actually keep them in that two-way role as pitchers and position players?
With Hunter Green, I think there's no chance just because of the positions. He's a pitcher and a shortstop, or he'd be a third baseman. And I think his ceiling is much higher as a pitcher. I mean, he's got just such a quick arm. He can hit 102 miles an hour with fastball, and he's so athletic. So he's a top of the draft guy as a pitcher, and he'd be more of a guy who'd probably go in the 15 to 25 range as a power hitting infielder who maybe moves over to third base. But there's just too much stress on your arm playing shortstop and third base. So I don't think with Hunter Green there's any chance he plays both ways. I mean, and I don't think there's any chance anybody would draft him as a hitter over a pitcher, but if he were just a hitter, he'd still be an interesting guy. McKay, he's interesting. I've said this many times. He fascinates me. I think outside of Dave Winfield, he's the best two-way prospect in baseball history from the standpoint of, I think those are only two guys that could have been top five picks for most teams as a hitter or a pitcher. And I don't think there's consensus. You know, different teams at the top of the draft look at McKay as a hitter or a pitcher. I think if he goes 1, 2, or 3 to the Twins, Reds, or Padres, they'll probably make him a pitcher. And I think if he goes 4 or 5 to the Rays or Braves, they'd probably make him a hitter. Now, he's a little different because it's left-handed pitcher and first base. So not necessarily a ton of strain on his arm at first base. He's played both, you know, about a 65-game college schedule and with Team USA. So he has experience doing both. And I think what's interesting is even if you prefer him as a pitcher, he's probably, assuming Louisville goes to the College World Series, which they're in the Super Regionals this weekend and they'll probably advance. I mean, he's got 2 or 3 starts left. And my guess is he's probably going to wind up around 110, 115 innings on the season. So even if you like him better as a pitcher, when you sign him, you're probably not going to do anything more, Ben, than let him pitch 2 or 3 innings at a time, you know, maybe 4 or 5 starts, let him pitch 10 or 15 innings in pro ball. And because he's such a good hitter, it would be a waste to have him only do that. So I think even these teams that I think would take him as a pitcher would be tempted to not let him pitch a whole lot to save his arm this summer after a long college season and let him hit. And if he does go to an American League team, you know, obviously, you know, it's a little different. You could make him a DH, you know, slash pitcher. You know, the question becomes, I think this is why we don't see guys try it until you see guys kind of at the end of their careers like a Brooks Kieschnick or a Christian Bethencourt who are trying to hang on by increasing the versatility. Mike Owings was another one. Is if you have him do both, you're probably not having him maximize his ceiling in either. So if you like him as a pitcher, you think he's a number two starter. If you like him as a position player, you think he might be the best all-around hitter in this draft, maybe a potential 320 home run guy. If you have him do both, you know, maybe you wind up with a number four guy and a guy who hits 280 with 15 homers. So, you know, which is better? I'm sure teams have – I would suspect that some of the teams have actually tried to analyze this and figure out what makes more sense. If you have a guy who's average to good, say, doing two things, or potentially great doing one? It's just such a fascinating question.
Yeah, it really is. And with guys like Shohei Ohtani around, and even to a lesser extent in the major leagues, you see the Michael Lorenzens of the world contributing on both sides of the ball. Do you think there's any sense that, okay, there's a little bit of momentum building toward this in a way that there might not have been 10 years ago?
Not really, because, again, I mean, with Lorenzen, I mean, you're not talking about a guy who's an ace starting everyday player. I mean, and he was a two-way guy at Cal State Fullerton, so, I mean, it wasn't like it came out of the blue, but it's more like Michael Lorenzen's ability to do both enhances his chances of staying on a major league roster, really. I mean, if you're looking at him, you know, I think he's more of a reliever than a starter. He's had a lot more success. But, you know, and then he can pinch hit. You know, and that's a relatively easy role. I think doing it as a starting pitcher and a semi-regular player is different than doing both. I mean, he's got, you know, the last 2 years when he's been a reliever, he's pitched, you know, 59 games in relief, and he's got 12 at-bats. So it's not like you're wearing him out doing both. I think the difference is if you think McKay's a number two starter, if you let him hit, do you prevent him from getting to that ceiling? Or, I would personally take him as a hitter. If I think he might be the best all-around hitter in the draft, if I have him worrying about pitching, you know, let's say every fifth day and then throw in between starts and, you know, the other preparation that goes into pitching, you know, maybe I'm not maximizing him as a hitter. I do think Ohtani is even more fascinating because there's a guy who can kind of dictate what he does. You know, Ohtani can tell U.S. teams, if you want to sign me, I want to play both ways, and it seems like he wants to. And if you don't let him, then you're probably not going to sign him. You know, McKay, you know, and I think he's, you know, at least publicly, and I don't think there's any hidden agenda, you know, he's kind of said all the right things. He'll do what the team wants him to do. I think he's curious about trying to do both, but it's not like Brendan McKay is going to tell whoever picks him, you know, near the top of the draft, hey, I'm turning down $6 million or whatever I'm going to get at the top of the draft if you don't let me play both ways. So Otani, I'm getting long-winded because this subject fascinates me.
Yeah.
I don't think we're going to see a push with more two-way guys. I think the guys like Lorenzen or Betancourt or Kieschnick or maybe Mike Owings who are maybe, you know, in that, you know, toward the end of your roster when you're filling out a 25-man roster, you know, they're the 20th or 25th best player on your team, it enhances their chances. I don't know outside of Otani that we're really going to see a team try to make a guy play both ways.
Too bad, but yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's
sense.
Fascinating. Yeah. You'd be kind of curious to see, but then I can kind of see the argument, too. I mean, that's another one of the other things that's real interesting with McKay is he's been so good for 3 years in college at Louisville playing both ways, and the feeling is with the college two-way guys is that they're going to get better when you have them do one. That as a pitcher, you know, McKay's stuff, you know, he's been tired toward the end of the season. He's pitching around 90 miles an hour right now, but McKay's stuff could pick up a notch or two when all he's doing is pitching and he's not wearing himself out playing a position the other, you know, the other 4 days. And, you know, similarly, if you had him focus full-time on hitting, you know, he's gotten better as a hitter every year. And if you really focused on it, you know, maybe, you know, he's even better than 300 with 20 home runs. So like I said, I don't think any teams would discuss it publicly.
Yeah.
But I'm sure teams have done studies trying to figure out, you know, are you better off having one guy who's average or a little bit better both ways or having a guy who's a potential star one way? And I don't even know the answer to that question.
Yeah, you mentioned those studies, and it kind of ties into the broader trend around baseball that's been going on for decades now, where there's so much information surrounding every kind of decision, especially a big decision. Do you find that teams are using more objective analysis than ever to make their draft picks in a way that they wouldn't have been 10 years, 20 years ago?
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, now that said, I think teams have always looked at statistics. I mean, they're more readily available, and you can get breakdowns, you know, as to what guys are doing against Friday night starters when the other team has their best pitcher on the mound. And, you know, I do think you can only read so much into college stats because the park factors are so wild. The competition, even when you play the same team, varies wildly depending on what day of the week you play them and what pitcher's on the mound. So teams always did kind of look at performance, and you'd look for red flags I'd say with the college statistics and high school statistics aren't really worth anything. Although the TrackMan data, where you're analyzing spin rates and exit velocities, I think that stuff has merit. And they do the same thing with some of the college guys. When you're just looking at pure college stats, there's so much noise in them that to me, guy with great stats, it doesn't actually mean he's going to be a major leaguer or a good major leaguer. I look more for red flags. You know, a guy who's throwing, say, you know, 95 miles an hour, but he's not missing bats. Or a guy who's supposed to be a good hitter, but he's striking out twice as much as he walks. Like, those are red flags to me. Although that said, Jeff Samardzija averaged about 4.5 strikeouts per 9 innings at Notre Dame, even though he threw very, very hard. You know, because he was kind of a one-pitch guy because he was playing football too. And, you know, and he kind of struggled along the same way early in his pro career. And he's had a very successful career. So even then, the red flags aren't be-alls and then-alls. But, yeah, I do think teams are looking, you know, not just at statistical information, but like I said, you know, trying to do studies or demographics. Hey, you know, what's the success rate of taking a high school catcher in the top 3 rounds? And, you know, I think any little piece of data that you can help inform a decision, you know, a lot of teams are looking at that because the hit rate in the draft, like in any draft, is not very high. You know, in your typical baseball draft, Ben, I mean, I know this sounds crazy because you're going to probably have, you know, 1,200 players or so drafted, and more than half of those guys will sign. But in your typical baseball draft, you might have a half dozen guys you would really call stars or superstars, and then you might have another couple dozen, if you're lucky, players who are solid regulars for a number of years, like either starting pitchers or in a lineup, and then you have a bunch of complimentary players and guys who get a cup of coffee. But I mean, in a typical draft, there might be 30 players you would describe as solid or better. Just for instance, I have a story that'll be up on MLB.com, I think tomorrow, where they had me go back and redraft the 2007 draft, knowing what we know now.
Right.
And the 30th pick in the first round was Tommy Hunter.
Wow.
I mean, and that's not a lie. I mean, Tommy Hunter's had a nice career.
True.
You know, I had Sean Doolittle at 29, and he's been hurt, and Nate Jones at 28. But that's what I'm saying. You know, Steven Souza, you know, at 27, Josh Kalmenter at 26. But those guys, if you were basing it, making picks now, 10 years later, based on what you know about guys, you know, those guys will all be first-round picks, which seems crazy. Steven Vogt would be a first-round pick. I mean, it's just there are not going to be – you know, everybody thinks their first, you know, hopes their first round pick is going to be this player you can build around. But really, if you get a, a reliever who has a 5 or 6 year career of usefulness, that's probably better than most first round picks.
Yeah, it's crazy when you put it that way. So have teams gotten better, you know, at finding the talent in the draft, or is it still just such a hard thing to do that you end up with a pretty high miss rate?
I like to think they're, for want of a better word, more scientific about it, so they're probably, the process is better. But I just think that the fact, it's so difficult that, A, I mean, you could have a pitcher scouted perfectly and have him down to a T. And we've both seen this. You've seen guys with great mechanics get hurt,
yeah.
And you've seen guys with bad mechanics stay healthy. But as you said, you could be the smartest guy in the world about pitching and make all the right pitcher picks, and a bunch of those guys could get hurt, and you don't get anything out of it. I mean, you know, Mark Pryor was supposed to be this guy with perfect mechanics. He couldn't stay healthy. And on the flip side, I mean, probably the biggest head whack I've ever seen a guy have was Max Scherzer in the fall league the year he signed. And every scout I talked to said some variation of, I would keep him in the bullpen and get him straight to the big leagues and get what I could out of him because he's going to blow out in 2 years. And Max Scherzer's never had an arm injury. And then on the position player side, I think the hardest thing to do is projecting whether guys are going to hit. You know, even though you have the high school showcase circuit and you see guys against better competition, or you have all these summer college leagues and you can see guys with wood bats, you just don't know. I mean, there are plenty of guys who've hit in high school, hit in college, hit up through AA, and then they hit the wall in AAA or the majors. So I do think teams probably have a better process, but the difficulty of what you're asking these people to do, which is to project guys, and it's not like the NFL or NBA where the guys are, you know, going straight to the big leagues the next year. I mean, you're projecting what guys are going to be, you know, basically 5 years down the road.
Yeah.
It's just so hard.
Yeah. So the guy facing that challenge for the Toronto Blue Jays, Steve Sanders, a new scouting director who came over from the Boston Red Sox where he was working in scouting. But this is going to be a new challenge for him. What do you know about Sanders and the challenge that he's facing here, taking on this first draft with the Blue Jays?
Yeah, I don't know a ton about Steve, but I do think that if I'm a Blue Jays fan, I'm heartened by the fact that he comes from a team that has had a pretty good track record of drafting for 10 or 15 years. And I think most of the guys that kind of implemented it are gone now. But they have a very, you know, I don't know, but I guess process is the best word. They have a process they follow that's been very successful, you know, not just performance and tools, but also makeup. And I think it's, that would be a good team to hire a scouting director from when you go look at their track record of what they've done. You know, and I think the nice thing for Steve is he gets two first-round picks this year. There's only three teams with two first-round picks. And you know, they're one of them. So you get, you know, they're not especially high, but he gets to pick 22 and 28. And you know, and it's like, it's really like people are starting to understand about the NFL draft. You know, and the hit rate is probably the same in the NFL. I mean, the difference is when you miss in the NFL or the NBA. You know, hockey's, you know, kind of more analogous to baseball, but like I don't think the teams miss any more in baseball than they do in the NFL or NBA. It's just when you miss in baseball, your guys don't play at the top level. And when you miss in the NFL or NBA, your guy at least play, you know, 99 times out of 100 are going to play at that level. They just aren't very good. But I think that if people are realizing the NFL draft, that nobody drafts, there's no team that drafts well every year in the NFL draft, which is why I think the smart teams try to hoard as many picks as they can, because you figure the more opportunities you have, the more likely you are to find a good player. And I think the same thing in baseball, where you can't hoard picks now. They've changed the compensation picks rules so that we don't have a 30-pick supplemental round anymore, and you can't trade picks. But if you could, I mean, that would be, I think, the strategy, the way to go in baseball, too, would be try to amass as many picks. So having two first-rounders in your first year is a nice luxury for Steve Sanders.
Yeah, definitely is. So it's even hard to anticipate what's going to happen in the first 10 picks, let alone at 22 or 28. Do you have any sense at all of what direction the Jays might look to go, what kind of players might be available in that type of 22, 28 territory?
Yeah, I mean, you're guessing. I mean, you kind of have an idea. I mean, at 22, you hear a lot of college bats. I mean, I've heard Evan White, who's first baseman from Kentucky. I don't know if he makes it there. Logan Warmoth, the shortstop from North Carolina, who's going to go right around that range. He's the best college shortstop, may have to switch positions. Keston Hiura, who's an outfielder, second baseman from UC Irvine, who may need Tommy John surgery, but might be the best pure hitter in the draft, and he leads college baseball in hitting and on base percentage. Those are all names I've heard. Nate Pearson, who's a junior college player from Florida, who just hit 102 miles an hour in a bullpen workout, probably the best fastball in college. I think he starts to go around there, and they'd also be in position, you know, maybe to take, I don't know if he'll quite go this high, but Brent Rooker's probably having the best offensive season of any college player at Mississippi State. You know, he could be in the mix if there's a run on bats and those guys are there. And then I've also heard them on some high school players. You know, the one area where I think you can always, I guess, get a relative bargain in the draft is high school right-handers, because teams are a little scared about the injury risk. And, you know, I mentioned it before. I mean, they do get hurt. But if you're willing to take them, I mean, they could take a guy like Sam Carlson out of Minnesota, Blaine Enloe out of Louisiana, Matt Sauer out of California are our high school arms. And maybe if they don't take one of those guys at 22, they grab one of them at 28.
Awesome. Well, Jim, we wish you luck during what's sure to be a very busy week ahead. We'll be watching you on the MLB Network broadcast Monday. We'll be reading you at MLBpipeline.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, good talking to you, Ben.
That'll do it for this week on At the Letters. Big thank you to Jim Callis from MLBpipeline.com for joining me to talk MLB Draft. Awesome insight from Jim, as always. And thank you as well to Arden Zwelling for his insight on the Toronto Blue Jays and for making the time while he is on the road reporting stories that you will soon be reading on sportsnet.ca. That's where to find this podcast. That's where you can find what I write, what Arden writes. You can find Arden on Twitter. He is at Arden Zwelling. Jim is on Twitter at Jim Callis MLB. Our producer, Sam McKee, is on Twitter at Sam A. McKee. And I am on Twitter at B. Nicholson Smith. And that is where you can find us. Until next time on At the Letters. We'll be right back.